Transmitting sound. Download complete. Now launching audio stream. The Kelly Alexander Show.
We're extremely happy to welcome three amazing R&B singers to the show talking about their new project, TGT, which stands for Tyrese, Genuine, and Tank. We're also excited to welcome to the show climatologist David Phillips talking about the recent rash of devastating tornadoes which have hit several areas of the U.S., including Oklahoma. Author Kim Shannon drops by to talk about putting your foot down and not always saying yes to everyone. It's about balance and taking care of your own life first.
Capture your need for sound.
We're very excited to be joined on the Kelly Alexander Show by three superstar R&B singers who have formed a supergroup, TGT, Tyrese, Genuine, and Tank. Guys, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having
us.
Yes.
So first of all, I wanted to ask you about the idea of forming this R&B supergroup. When did it happen, and how long did it take you guys to make it all work out?
Great, Tank. You haven't been doing a lot of talking.
it actually really just always been kind of a joke just tossed around, you know, of all of us just being on stage together since we've all been friends for so long, you know. But me and Genuine, we want to play together, and you know, anytime that song Pony come on, I just feel like it's my obligation to come on stage and sing backgrounds. You know what I mean? Cause that's how I started. So, you know, every night we just end the show like, man, we got to do this all the time. We got to be a group, and we'd laugh about it. But, you know, one night it got real serious. Like, you know, it was like a real, well, we should be a group, and let's call Tyrese and let's see if he want to do a group. And he was like, man, I do want to do a group. And it started in 97, and you know, what started out as just an idea and a few shows has turned into a major recording deal and a major tour and an album release date, so forth and so on. So which is real excited that, you know, after all these years of hard work and just trying to formulate this thing and put it together the right way, it's finally come together and the fans finally have something tangible that is TGT.
Tyrese, can you talk about orchestrating everyone's schedules? Because I know you guys are all individually so busy. You're off making movies, you're off doing this, that, and something else. So was it hard to finally sit down and make it all happen?
You know what, to be honest, when you really want to make something happen, you make it happen. And, you know, excuses sound best to the person that's making them up. At the end of the day, we all want this. We all been wanting it. And, you know, when those moments with certain issues of not being on the same page come up, because all three of us are grown solo artists, been solo, so we all got our own formula of what it takes to win and become successful. Sometimes things get a little sticky, and so for me, my motivation is God, because I feel like this situation is blessed from the beginning. But more than anything, we all have a history, 10 years plus, and so there's nothing we can't figure out. And then I always think about the fans. And we've let them down before, from jumping the gun to try and do the TGT thing. And so now that we're here, as far as I'm concerned, we can't let it break up and fall apart. We got to keep going and make sure that it gets to the height that it can possibly get to. And afterwards, after this first album, we go do our solo albums, and then we do TGT all over again.
That is fantastic. I think a lot of your fans are going to be so excited about this. And Genuine, can you speak to us about the state of R&B? Because I remember reading something recently that Jermaine Dupri said, I believe, where he was like, you know, the sound of R&B has changed so much. And I know on his end, it sounds like he wants to bring it back to that sort of like, you know, 90s sound, obviously in a today formula, but that real R&B. And it sounds like this is what you guys are trying to come up with your album Three Kings.
Absolutely. I think, you know, every generation has their form of music and their sound that they love and they try to stick to. And the state of R&B right now, I mean, this is where it is. I think back in the days when we were listening to music and our parents was listening to what we was listening to, they probably were saying the same thing. Oh, that ain't real music. That ain't real R&B music. But every generation has their own style and their music. But for me, you know, I came up with Jodeci, Guy, New Edition, and all those artists. So we're just trying to take it back to that, because that's what we grew up on and that's what we're used to. And hopefully everybody supports us once we come to the city, because I think everyone that's coming out to see us, they've, you know, followed us for a long time, and they, you know, they love that sort of music as well. So we're looking forward to it, and hopefully everybody come out and support us.
Tank, now you guys are heading out on tour. What can we expect the stage show to be like?
We got a few different scenarios, you know what I mean? We're definitely going to give you a lot of TGT, you know what I mean? It's going to be, I think, great for the fans to see this on stage together, you know, interacting and, you know, and really vibing out. As you see from our first video, Sex Never Felt Better, it really kind of gives you a glimpse of what that looks like, and I think that's what the people really want to see. Along with that, you know, we're going to go into our solo moments and give them all the reasons why they love us individually, and then we're going to come right back and give them, you know, these fresh new TGT moments.
Tyrese, what do you want the fans to take away from not only the single but the album? Is it a collection of songs, or is there like a running theme throughout?
Well, we got 15 songs total with all three of us singing on it. This is what's crazy. It's like a little insight. We all said we're going to do a whole album, and then we was like, yo, you know what? We got to do some individual songs too, some solo songs on the album. And so we ended up doing so many records that were so special. It was like, we don't actually want to keep any of these songs to ourselves, because it's like, well, I love that song. Well, I love it too. Well, damn it, I'm singing on it. And it's just beautiful. Like, if we get in any arguments right now, we're trying to figure out how can we get more songs on the album, because we love so many. We hate to have to chop any of them. Right. So we just, like, you know, we've all had our share of success individually, like I said, even with our, you know, solo thing. But I don't think any of us has done an album that has so much significance and as special, because, you know, the energy just changes up. When Tank starts singing, he brings Tank. I bring Tyrese, and he brings G. And you can actually tell the difference in each one of our voices individually. It's like sometimes you'll hear groups, and you're like, who's singing that part? But, you know, you hear us clearly singing individually. And I think people are going to be impressed with the direction of the album and the song concepts. And more than anything, like Tank said, when y'all see us live in concert, it's going to be nothing like you've ever experienced.
Genuine, who did you guys work with as writers and producers on the album? Are there names that a lot of R&B fans would recognize as producers?
You ain't never heard of any of them. No.
Yeah, we worked with a variety of people, but I forgot Brenda's last name. But we're in the studio. We're in the studio right now with the Underdog, and that's pretty much the biggest.
Absolutely. Yeah, that was the Underdog.
The most established that you will hear on this album, the Underdogs. Everybody else is geniuses, but yeah. They're called Too Loud.
That's good. It's good you're bringing the new.
Yeah, you know, we're going to bring in some new talent, and I think people will love them as well. But yeah, we're still in the studio. Actually, we actually finished yesterday, so we're just fine-tuning some things in the Underdog studio. But then we're pretty much done.
Fantastic. Now, can you guys talk about social media? Because when you all three hit it, you know, years ago when you first came out, social media was not even a thing. So, what's your take on it, and how important is it for you to get that personal connection to your fans now through like Twitter and Facebook?
Are you asking all of us, or
whoever wants to answer that one?
Thank you. Want to answer that? I quit.
I think, you know, Tyrese has a gazillion followers on everything, so he likes to really use his thumbs.
He really likes to use his thumbs. Shut off to my thumbs, homie.
Yeah, I'm just really getting my social media game like up and running and intact. So, but it's very important because, I mean, you're able to reach out to people who probably normally wouldn't listen to your music, but because social media crosses so many different genres of people and generations of people, that you're just able to, you know, send things and get that instant and immediate gratification, you know what I mean? And people get to decide for themselves whether they want it or not, and not just waiting for your record company or waiting for the promotional team to get it to them, but you can actually, you know, do some work yourself and help build your own career. So I'm really excited that social media is in place, you know what I mean, kind of put some of the power back into our hands.
Tyrese, can you talk about, like, the fact that you guys are already this super group with three established singers coming together as this group? But is there anyone else out there that eventually, because you mentioned earlier in the interview that TGT is going to be a long-term project. So is there an artist or a group or a producer that you guys would like to collaborate with down the road and, you know, just work together and have that song come out?
Well, I'm going to be honest with you. Coming off of my last run, as far as my solo album where I was independent, and I don't say this to toot my own horn, but the fact that the album versus a single or a song ended up with a Grammy nomination, with a Grammy-nominated album, and you've never heard of any of the singers, writers, and producers on the album, it says a lot about what people want these days. They just want real music that they can connect to and that makes them feel good. I think right now we're slowly seeing that name dropping, having a bunch of features, and trying to create all of this hype around projects produced by this, produced by that, that don't really matter. And, you know, people just want music that feels good. And I think at the end of the day, when people hear this album, it's going to make them want to read the credits, and they're going to be like, huh? Who did? Who? Never heard. And so what we end up doing is we end up setting the tone and creating new standards in music from guiding and molding and shaping brand new producers and writers, you know, just kind of coaching them and helping them to give us what we want. And again, we do have the underdogs that came to the plate and worked with us musically, but at the end of the day, about 85% of the album came from a bunch of brand new producers and songwriters that a lot of people have never heard of, and we say that proudly. But you will not be able to tell that this album was made by brand new producers and writers, because it sounds that great.
Genuine, do you have any thoughts or advice to the younger acts that are coming up now? Like, where, you know, because you've been around for a while and you have experience. And what would you say to the younger cats that are coming up right now who maybe need some advice? Because it seems like a lot of people expect instant gratification and not molding their careers like all three of you have done.
Well, through my career, I've been here, you know, for a while now. And I've just learned you have to wear more than one hat. You can't just be an artist no more. You really have to take control of a lot of the things that's around you. And, you know, you just got to pay attention. I've had my ups and downs in this business with, you know, lawyers and accountants, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And you can no longer just be just an artist and just worry about your artistry, which is sad in a way, because you really want to, you know, focus on what you're doing. But you have to really now wear more than one hat. You cannot just be an artist, because, you know, people will take a lot from you. And I've had my, you know, issues, but, you know, with the cats now, you know, you just really got to wear more than one hat, and you got to always be, you know, out there on the social media and doing everything you can possibly do to stay relevant and stay in everyone's face, because there's so many artists out there now. You don't really even have to have a huge deal anymore to become a celebrity or a star, so, you know, to make yourself different, you have to stay on the internet. You have to stay on all the social medias. You have to, again, wear more than one hat. So that's the advice that I would give.
Now, Tank, we know that you guys are heading out on tour, but what can we expect from TGT in the next, like, 12 to 18 months? Obviously, the album's coming out, but is there any other surprises that you want your fans to know about?
I mean, we're just, you know, we're plugging away as far as the tour and the album. The album is really our focus. We think that, you know, this album having a strong debut and just being the right thing for R&B is just going to catapult a lot of different things into the atmosphere, you know what I mean? It's going to create new budgets for, you know, new R&B artists, and, you know, labels and investors are going to see the value of investing more money and investing more time into good R&B music based on what we're able to achieve. So, that's really our focus right now, you know what I mean? We lose Ty in September because, you know, he's leading like three different lives, three different successful lives, so we support him as he moves on to Fast 7, you know, so we'll probably be jumping on the set, hanging out with him, and then come top of the year, we'll be right back for, you know, another uh, another phase of TGT, which will probably be overseas or something like that, and then going into our solo album. So it's really focused on the Three Kings album, man. We want to make this thing big. We want to make it exciting. And we want to make it inspiring for all those who want to do R&B.
Fantastic, guys. Thank you so much and all the best.
Thank you. Bless you, man. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Tyrese, Genuine, and Tank. To learn more about their new album, Three Kings, coming out, and everything to do with their social media, jump onto their website, tgtlife.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
As global warming continues across this planet, we continue to see more and more storms. Climatologist for Environment Canada, David Phillips, joins us to talk about some of the extreme weather we've seen in the past few weeks and what we can look forward to this summer. David, welcome back to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Kelly, nice to be with you again.
So can we start by talking about tornadoes? Because, you know, just to set the scene, obviously we've all been fascinated the last several weeks by what's been going on in Tornado Alley. So can we talk about how tornadoes are actually formed, like what draws it? Because I find a lot of times Canada gets blamed for this, or part of it.
Well, you're right. Americans blame us for lots of cold weather in the winter and storms and blizzards. And my gosh, I always think more of our poor weather comes from the state. So it's tit for tat, I suppose. A lot of buzz about the tornado season this year. At the beginning, Kelly, it was all about where were the tornadoes. The United States, they had probably one of the quietest beginnings up till May that they'd ever seen in terms of any tornadoes. They'd never gone through such a period. In fact, most of the in April, which is usually the deadliest month for tornadoes in the United States, they had more winter storms. It was just too much cold. Maybe Canadian air around, but we saw a pattern, a circulation pattern change in May, and what was missing were was the Gulf of Mexico, the humid air coming up from the south into Little Tornado or Tornado Alley, which is usually Texas, Oklahoma, Missouri, Kansas, that area there, where they could probably see 500, 600 tornadoes in an average year. Certainly more, over half of the tornadoes in the United States are found in that geographical area. So what you got was the humidity. Now, to get a tornado to form, a lot of things have to come together, fortunately. You know, in North America, we probably see about 100,000 thunderstorms, but only about 1,000 of those will produce a tornado. And which one of those clouds will rotate is still a great scientific mystery. And really, that's what a tornado is. It's just a cloud. It's just a condensation. And yet, when it spins, like a skater pulling in her or his arms, the speed will pick up. So what you begin with is a day where the sun is baking the ground, the warm air is rising, the moisture is condensing, releasing some heat, and then you have an inflow of humid air. It's almost like the gasoline for an engine. It keeps it fueled. And then what you have to have is kind of a trigger mechanism, something that kind of would just make it just not a garden variety thunderstorm, but a real megastorm. And this could be a lake or a sea breeze could blow in. You could have the jet stream could come in. You could have a wedge of dry air from the west or cool air from the north that could sort of undercut that warm air and kind of kick it up. But the key thing, Kelly, is you have to have some contrasting air, because that's why we don't see a lot of tornadoes in the tropics. It's just too warm and too humid. But when you get that kind of warm, humid air rising, and then you get some dry a slot of air coming from the west or some cool, dry Canadian air, well, it will cause typically some rotation. It'll cause almost what we would refer to as wind shear, different winds coming at different directions, different speed, to cause that tube of air that's rising to kind of rotate. And that's really how you get these tornadoes. And what we saw in May in the United States, we saw all of the ingredients coming together. And then, of course, what made the big buzz is that these tornadoes were hitting well-populated areas. Oklahoma City, my gosh, put to rest that myth about tornadoes don't hit cities. They only hit trailer parks and recreational vehicles. Not. Oklahoma City has been hit probably more than any other city in the world, 150 times in the the last, say, 80 to 100 years. And they were big ones. We saw one of the widest tornado ever seen in history, over 4 kilometers wide. The second deadly one that came through, and the previous one was the one that, of course, hit a lot of talk. The one that in Moore, Oklahoma, that destroyed 2 schools and killed, I think, about 23 people.
David, can I ask you to focus for a second on something that you just mentioned about the myth about coming into cities? Because I think a lot of people, myself included in the past, like I would have said, oh, you know, if I'm in the middle of wherever, I'm probably okay. Can you explain, like, for example, with that Moore tornado, I know it seemed to, from what I understand, really hit the suburbs, but can it go like right downtown where there would be skyscrapers and such?
Oh, absolutely. There's nothing about a central business district, about the busy part of a city, that could deter one of these tornadoes if it wants to come down. It's just that, Kelly, that cities represent such a small portion of the land use of this planet, probably 2 or 3%. There are many more cornfields or forested areas or wheat fields or agricultural plots. And so that's often why tornadoes, we seem to think, hit those areas more than the cities. But places like Wichita, Dallas, Texas, I mean, my gosh, New York City, which is along the coast, they have been hit, you know, 50, 60 times with, now, small guys, you know, not the monster tornadoes that we saw in Oklahoma, but little ones. But yes, they were funnel clouds that touched the ground and legally were tornadoes. And Montreal, well, we don't hear about tornadoes in Montreal. Toronto, maybe you could count it on your hand, the number of tornadoes have been hit down. But hey, it's not necessarily a popular area for tornadoes, because not all the ingredients come together. But there's nothing about cities that would suggest that we're safe in cities. It is now. There's safer in the sense that we have more structures that you could seek shelter. And that was one of the problems with Oklahoma, is they don't build basements in Oklahoma. The only thing that you could have saved you if you were hit by that tornado in Oklahoma, whether it be Moore or the one last week, was getting underground. You had to be below the ground, below the surface. Well, they don't have, unless you have tornado shelters, which some homes like have hot tubs in Canada, well, they have storm shelters to be, you know, you could add that as an extra to your home. So we clearly in Canada are probably in better condition, because we don't see as many tornadoes. Obviously, we're the second most tornado-prone country in the world. We get 60 to 80 in an average year, but it pales by U.S. standards, which they probably see around 1,200.
Now, much has been made, David, about Tornado Alley. I mean, I've known about that term since I was a kid in elementary school. And you just spoke about how Canada, you know, has sort of the next amount. Is there... So obviously the U.S. and Canada, this seems to be the prone area. Are there other areas around the world that get struck as well in a significant manner?
Well, there are. I mean, it is really, it's a weather phenomenon. It's not a national phenomenon. It's not somebody that has, sort of a corner on that particular. It's just that the frequency in England, for example, they've had tornadoes. They tend to be very tiny ones. I mean, no EF5s, the biggest category of them. And they tend to come maybe in September, October, where you have, you know, a little bit of moist air, a little bit of cool air comes in, and it just seems to be a populated Australia. They get tornadoes there. In Russia, in fact, I just show you how rare they are, but it's a huge country, and you would think that where the warm air would duke it out with the cold air, well, you would expect more. But back in 2011, there was a Russian city in the far eastern part of the country, I can't even pronounce it, where there was a tornado swept through and killed one person, probably the only documented death from a tornado in Russia. So United States and Canada, this is where the battleground for the warm, the cold, the dry, the humid air comes together. It's really a war zone, and that's probably where the United States gets more severe weather than any other country on this planet, because of its latitude. It is and geography. I mean, that area of Oklahoma, it's not mountainous, it's prairie, it's flat. You can see from horizon to horizon, which is encourages that coming together of the competing air masses, which could turn these clouds into rotating terrorists as we sometimes call them. So it's just the right ingredients there. And we had in Canada a little area between Windsor, Ontario, and Barrie near Lake Simcoe called Little Tornado Alley. And again, you have those that heat, humidity, but you also have the lake breeze coming off Lake Huron, Lake Erie, and it could cause tornadoes to occur. In Canada, we've already had in Ontario this year, here we are in early part of June, we've had 7 tornadoes in Ontario, we've had 1 in Quebec, we've had 1 in Saskatchewan, so our season is just beginning. The season, we take a little longer to come for the warm and the humid air arrives. The cool air is always there, but it's when the warm, humid air comes in June and July that we begin to see more tornado outbreaks. And you know, last year, one of the most interesting stories of all, Kelly, was that in that tornado alley in the United States, Oklahoma, for example, there were more tornadoes in Saskatchewan last year than there was in Oklahoma. So we're not immune from these most powerful storms on Earth. So sometimes it comes right down to it. I know this doesn't sound very scientific, but sometimes it comes down to, you know, bad luck. Mm-hmm. You know, the fact that it would hit here and not over there, that you look up there and you see all those clouds and you say, well, which one of those is going to rotate? Which one is going to produce a tornado? Mm-hmm. You know, and that's the big mystery of science. You know, we know a lot about tornadoes and why they form. We just can't tell which one is going to rotate and create the kind of tornado that that will strike a community. Until we can fly into that tornado and see the three-dimensional structure of it, we're going to be a long ways away from. We're better at forecasting them, at least the conditions that can produce them. Mm-hmm. But exactly where they're going to touch down is still one of science's great mysteries.
Joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show is climatologist for Environment Canada, David Phillips. David, can you explain the Fujita scale? Because, for example, I remember learning about that sort of in school and knowing about, you know, F1s and F2s and all that kind of stuff. But now I understand they've added an E in front of it, like an EF scale. So can you explain what's going on with that? Because that's new to me.
Well, that is new. It's a new thing this year. The United States have been doing it now for 2 or 3 years. In Environment Canada, we began using the EF scale, the Enhanced Fujita scale, in April of this year. We've already had a few tornadoes, as I say, that we have rated as an EF, E1, E2. Now, both scales are similar in the sense that they both have 6 categories. You go from EF 0 to EF 5, for example, and just to give you a wind speed, an EF 0 would be a winds from maybe 90 to 130 kilometers per hour. An EF 5, which we saw 2 of them in Oklahoma in less than 11 days, these would be winds of over 315 kilometers per hour. That one's sort of open-ended at the end. We saw winds in a week ago in Oklahoma that reached 475 kilometers per hour, and hey, not many structures could be around at that time. But what, Kelly, what scientists and building contractors and architects realized that the Fujita scale, which had been in use for about 40 years, had limitations. It was rather an arbitrary type of scale. And what research since then has looked at the fact that, you know, that the same wind can cause different damages to different structure. And a lot of times you have to look at how the structure is built. You know, 40 years ago, buildings weren't structured or built as strong as they are now. And so what this scale does, more with correlations, looking at particular structures, whether they be schools or strip malls or factories, they will have a better understanding of what winds will do what damage. For example, if you take a look at one of the criteria you looked at, we look at warehouses, and there are 7 different descriptors that are available to say, well, how strong would the wind be to cause damage? For example, could it just be some roof damage, or could there be an overhead doors that have been collapsed? Could it be these precast concrete could be destroyed, or a total wipeout of the building where it's just it's into the next county? So each one of those would cause, of course, different strengths of wind. And so by looking, first of all, making an assessment, yes, there was an eyewitness report, there were pictures, there were videos, we know there was a tornado there. Now we look at the damage and we see, well, okay, no, because no wind sensor would record the damage, it'd be gone, it'd be blown away. So we look at the damage and we say, okay, based on that that factory or that warehouse, we know that the winds reach this particular level. And so that's why we have, we feel a little bit more, it's a more rigorous scale, and that's why we've talked about it as an enhanced Fujita scale, and a little better, so they were comparing apples with apples, storm damage in Saskatchewan and Oklahoma. We can look at the particular damage it does to buildings, and we can rate it in the same scale.
David, can you also talk to us a little bit about, for example, the tornado that happened in Moore and then the one following that killed those storm chasers? Because here's the thing, like when you see the footage from a tornado, you know, you see the funnel and you see what's going on. But I wanted to talk to you a little bit, I guess, in this particular question about how far out the winds are actually, because you think the main chaos is in that sort of immediate area of the funnel. But how far out are the winds really picking up? Because I think, you know, you see these amateur storm chasers running around and I'm always like, you're in danger even if you're probably a mile and a half away, are they not?
Well, they are. Now, it really depends, though. Unlike a hurricane is much, it's the largest storm on Earth. If tornadoes are the most powerful storms on Earth, hurricanes are, in fact, the largest because certainly you're much more at risk in a larger area, a larger part of the geography being captured by this. It really, Kelly, comes down to the width of that tornado. Sometimes I have seen a tornado in my community, destroy one home, and the home next door, the petals were still on the flowers. I mean, it really was meters wide. And typically, an average tornado would be about 100, 150, 200 meters wide. But what we saw last week, a tornado that was the widest ever measured, 4 kilometers wide. In fact, if that tornado came over you, you would not even know that you were in a tornado. It wouldn't look like an elephant's nose, you say. Mm-hmm. So really, the strength of the wind is really, it's typically in a tornado situation. The storm itself can cause damage. The Edmonton tornado back in 1987, it was a strong tornado, a lot of wind damage, but it was a lot of hail damage, a lot of flooding rains. We saw that in Oklahoma last week. We had flooding in intersections up to the door handles of cars. So there are a lot of things that can get you, but it's the wind, it's the debris flying around with inside that elephant's nose. Now, I guess they say you'd have wind damage, but it wouldn't be severe wind damage away from the center of that. But it's where that center passes over you, that is where the winds are the most violent. They're rotating at a phenomenal rate, and this is what causes the debris to be lifted up and put into the air. And then, of course, what kills you or injures you in a tornado is the flying debris. It's not the wind itself, but it's the fact that little pebbles are like bullets. A straw is like spears. Bricks, can you imagine picking up SUVs and just tossing them 2 kilometers away and that SUV crashing into your mobile home? Well, there wouldn't be anything left of it, you see. So really, it is the winds are stronger right in the center, right at the within that elephant's nose. But beyond that, it's typically strong winds, hail, and heavy rains that could create the issue.
And what's your opinion, David, on this? Because, for example, that second tornado that hit after the Moore one, where it killed those storm chasers and several people that were stuck in traffic. I wanted to ask you about that because I'm very fascinated by tornadoes as well as hurricanes and all that sort of stuff. So, of course, I was watching like all the coverage. And I remember, you know, I saw one family and they had been prepared to, you know, get into their bathtub and put a mattress over themselves. And what happened is the wife freaked out and she's like, I'm leaving. And the husband's like, no, we need to, you know, get in the bathroom. She's like, no, I'm out. And so she was running to the car. So obviously he followed her. They left. They came back 15 minutes later. Their house was gone. So they would have never survived in the bathtub. But how do you, like, what would be your piece of advice? Do you stay or do you go? Because, like, again, we look at that second tornado. Many people died in cars because they were stuck in traffic. So what would your advice be?
Well, Kelly, my advice would be don't drive. You can't outrun tornadoes. And even worse is that you're not sure. When you look at it, you're not sure what direction there it's coming. Is it going away from you? Or is it coming towards you? And typically when we've seen deaths from people in cars, you know, it has really been in traffic accidents. And we saw in Oklahoma last week, we saw people driving down the wrong side of they were panicking, they were screaming, they were yelling. It was just an incredible, horrible scene. People just couldn't, there were traffic accidents, and then, of course, the tornado came down and picked the car up and rolled it or tossed it, and we saw a number of deaths. There was a meteorologist, award-winning meteorologist in Oklahoma City, who I think didn't provide very good advice. He told people to run for the hills, to get out of, if they don't have a basement, to get out of town. And, of course, people heeded his advice and drove right into the eye of the storm, so to speak, and some lost their life. So he feels bad. I think in a panic, he made the wrong choice or the wrong advice. We always say to people, if you're in a car, get out of the car. Don't drive away. Don't try and flee the tornado. It's best to be outside and or seeking safe shelter. If you can get to a basement, a storm cellar, something like that, you get away. If you're outside, then the advice is always to go into a depression, a dip, a little valley. You've got to be careful of the flooding that could occur. And what you want to do, though, I think, Kelly, is to make sure you cover your head or your neck. There's so many people in tornadoes that are decapitated by the flying debris. And what you want, the most vulnerable part of your body, is your neck and your head. And so when you get down in the basement, you get on the ground, get on the basement floor, underneath the Chesterfield, underneath the work table, underneath the stairs, cover your head, and often you will survive. There have been so many examples of tornadoes this year in Oklahoma where people either had a storm, like a storm room, which it often would be just like a little clothes closet, well into the interior of the building, which is maybe a little bit more reinforced with cinder blocks, and we're in there. A bathroom is a good place to be. I mean, not always. Sometimes the storms are so huge that there's no safe place except if you're underground. And so certainly now, if you're in a car, you get to a shelter or into a ditch or a ravine and what have you. And you know, this probably what we saw this year. We saw three experienced storm chasers that were killed by a tornado. Just actually plucked a couple of them out of their vehicle. These were recognized world-class scientists who were caught in traffic jams or had car failures. But you know, there were a lot of yahoos out there. There were a lot of these thrill seekers or looking for their 15 minutes of fame, and that were absolutely, what scared one veteran storm chaser was all of the screaming and the yelling, and not from people frightened. It was like the July 4th fireworks display, that people were just absolutely, it was an adrenaline rush. And, you know, these hundreds of rubberneckers or honking horns, drinking beer and yelling and screaming, it was almost an entertainment for them. And what we saw in that terrible disaster were 20 deaths and dozens and dozens of more people injured and many frightened out of their wits.
David, before I let you go, I just wanted to speak to you about storm chasers for just a moment. You know, there's conflicting reports, I think, depending on what you read and or what you listen to. In your opinion, and obviously you've been doing this for a long time, you're very well respected. Is there a place for, I know they can't be accredited, but I can use that word, like accredited storm chasers, like do they really help? Can they help with storm information for tornadoes?
Well, they can. I mean, I think I encourage professional meteorologists, people who are very cautious, people who know the lethal aspects of these storms, to continue to do what they do. And they're often, when you read about them, they're very cautious people. There are certain people I would go storm chasing with because they know so much about the dynamics of the storm, where are the damaging parts, where's the real fear. You know when to... and of course, they have vehicles that are like built like army tanks, you know, that they're reinforced but more than anything, they want to get close to it, but they don't want to catch it. They want to be able to film it, to put an instrument in its way so that they can learn about how strong the winds were or the pressure or the kind of changes that took place. There's absolutely no place for these, thrill seekers, these yahoos that, or tourists, whether tourists go out there and try and chase them. They, in the past, it used to be that, you know, the most fear of professional storm chasers were the others, the traffic jams, and the worst damage. Well, you might have been hit by lightning. There's been one case where somebody was hit by lightning or hail, a lot of damage from hail. But it's the first time that any professional storm chaser has ever been killed, and I think it will helpfully put a damper on people. Agreed. But you know what, Kelly? It's just the technology. You know, we have cell phones, we have smartphones, camcorders. We have there's more. We're observing tornadoes more. You know, the number of tornadoes has gone way up, but it's not climate change. It's just the fact that we're observing more. We have more people looking for them and trying to spot them. More people trained, better communication, more lead time for tornadoes. So, you know, the science and the communication of the disaster is improving, but there are always risks involved with these monster storms that unfortunately are not as common as one might think. In fact, one of my favorite statistics, if you were in Oklahoma or in that area of Tornado Alley and you pitched a tent, well, for winds to come and knock your tent down, well, you'd have to be there for over 1,000 years. So they are still rare, mm-hmm. and they are small, but boy, they seem to be hitting more communities because communities are growing, you say. They're getting larger. And I remember one person said, you know, it would have been absolutely biblical, the proportion of disaster and damage, if that last week's tornado had hit Oklahoma City. That wide tornado, that EF5, the biggest tornado that we could ever scale, If that hit a field and a highway, it didn't go near a built-up area. If it got to a built-up area, it would have been absolutely incredible, the loss of life and damage.
David, as always, thank you so much for your time. I always learn a lot, and I know my listeners do too. So thank you so much for your time today.
Well, Kelly, I appreciate that. Thank you so much. We'll talk again.
That's climatologist for Environment Canada, David Phillips, on The Kelly Alexander Show.
KellyAlexanderShow.com.
Are you someone who has a hard time saying no to people? If so, then you won't want to miss out on our next guest. Kim Shannon considers herself to be a good girl who always used to follow those good girl rules. To be perfect, to be a people pleaser, and to always say yes because saying no is bad. But how can you break that cycle without feeling as though you've let someone down? Kim joins us to talk about putting your foot down and saying no so that you can have more time to enjoy more of the things in your life. Kim, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So, Kim, let's talk about what makes us good girls. Is there a way that you can sort of break that good girl way? And I guess what is a good girl in the grand scheme of things?
Yeah, absolutely. So good girls are women who... There are women all over the world who are born expected to be good girls. We're born expected to learn the rules of how to be good. And as we grow up, these rules, and the top three are learning to please others, learning to strive for perfection, and learning that yes is so much more ladylike than saying no. And as we grow up, these rules... You know, they worked for us when we were kids because they got us what we wanted. But when we're adults, they can confine us and keep us small and keep us from getting what we want. So my work is all about breaking these rules so that we can really define our own rules for ourselves and live powerfully, not just surviving, but thriving.
Now, you talk a lot about how addictions can play a big role in being a good girl. How is that?
Well, good girls, you know, everybody gets addicted to something. Addiction isn't just relegated to alcohol or drugs or cigarettes. You know, we can get addicted to shoes. We can get addicted to salt or sugar. We can get addicted to things. And for good girls, because we grow up to be people pleasers, we can get addicted to saying I'm fine, to doing things that we don't really want to do because other people want us to do them. We can get addicted to putting our needs last. So, and all of these things contribute to us not feeling powerful in our lives.
When you become a, you know, good girl, quote unquote, does that start like super early in life, like just because of the people, obviously the people around you are putting that in your consciousness. So when does it actually, like, can you even be like into your adulthood before you even realize that this has happened to you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think for me personally, I always knew that I was expected to be a good girl. I mean, you know, for most of us, and for most of my clients, you know, you hear the words good girl, or if you have boys, you hear the word good boy, be a good boy and go do this, be a good girl and go do this. There's an expectation that comes when we're born, and it does start really early, and you can go through living up to the expectations of others and then also having your own expectations of what good means, and that if you don't live up to that expectation, then we can be really hard on ourselves. I talk about having an inner bully, and, you know, there's so much bullying in the world, and it starts at home. It's that tape that runs 24/7 that goes, you know, you didn't do it right, or you didn't say it right, or you're not good enough. And good girls and good boys have that tape going for them because the idea of living up to the expectation of good, you know, it's unattainable in a way. It's a carrot being held out because it's basically when you're told as a kid, you know, be a good girl and do this, there's a subconscious thing going on that says, you know, if you don't do this, you're not good. So we're always trying to strive for something that is somewhat out of reach.
Do you find that good girls or good boys, whatever, if they have had this, you know, label put upon them, if you will, and then they sort of live their life that way, that if they break free for even a moment, it's like the world has ended? Because I know,
yeah.
Like, I know, for example, just the way I was raised, like, there was no question, like, you had to be responsible, especially because I'm a farm kid, so there was a lot of, you know, mm-hmm. being responsible yeah. for the animals and all that kind of stuff. And then there was just, like, this added expectation. And so I know now, even in my adulthood, that I don't easily, like, run buck wild. Not that anyone should, but, like, I always have this high standard. Like, I always have, like, a super high standard of myself. And, like, if mm-hmm. I don't meet it, I'm like, what did you do there?
Mm-hmm. So absolutely.
So I'm assuming, like, that can sort of play throughout your life unless you're cognizant of it.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting. I have a client who came to me about a year ago, and she was really struggling. She was really struggling with her roles because she grew up a good girl, and she grew up with this expectation of what a good mom means and what a good wife means and what a good daughter means, what a good businesswoman means. And so she was trying to fulfill all these roles, and she was trying to keep herself, like you, Kelly, and like me, to such a high standard that she wasn't able to really be happy or really kind of live into all of these roles and make them her own. She was always looking at these roles as kind of outside of herself. Like, if I do this, I'll be considered a good mom. Or if I do that, then I'll be considered a good wife. And it kind of took out who she was as an individual
mm-hmm.
In the mix. You know what I mean? It's not about going buck wild. When you get to the point, like for her, she woke up one morning and was just like, what about me? When is it my time? You know, I've done it exactly the way I was told to do it. I've done it exactly the way I was supposed to.
Mm-hmm.
And yet I'm not really happy. Like, I, you know, I'm doing it. I have it, but it's not really fulfilling. And
mm-hmm.
that was the starting point for her, where she really, you know, it became too painful because she wanted to be she wanted her needs met and her happiness included.
Okay. Joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show is empowerment expert and author Kim Shannon. For more information, make sure to check out their website, goodgirlsanonymous.com. How does your own fears play a role in holding us back from experiencing new things? Like, I think this is sort of what we've been talking about, but it just seems like if you're not self-aware that this is going on, you really can be held back.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Fear plays a huge role, you know. there are three fears I think really hold us back. I do a lot of work with women on learning how to say no, because no seems to be a bad word, or we associate it with being a bad person. And the three fears that get in the way are fear of rejection, which starts super early. You know, a lot of us, no was our first word, and we learned early that no made people mad, or no made people send us to our room.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
another fear is fear of missing out. If we say no or we don't please others, then we're going to miss out on something in our life. We're not going to be fully in our life. And the third is the one that really got me and held me stuck for many years, was the fear of the unknown.
Right.
And those three fears really play into whether or not we are going to change, or whether or not we are going to stay, you know, stay with what we know where it's comfortable.
Okay. Can I also ask you about saying no to some things? Because like you mm-hmm. were talking about earlier, I think you're sort of ingrained to say like, yes, I'll do that, and I'll, you know, no problem and whatever. It must be really hard initially to put your foot down and say, no, I'm sorry, I can't bake those brownies or whatever it is.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It takes, you know, what I talk about is building the no muscle, because, you know, we are brought up to, you know, women are the caretakers, right? We want to please, we want to make other people happy. And saying no, you know, you don't want to make people mad. You don't want to make people upset. You want to be that person that people go to. So when you really get to the point, like for me, I didn't even know how to spell the word no. Mm-hmm. When I realized, I was like, oh, I don't even know how to even possibly say that. I had to work on building my no muscle.
Mm-hmm.
And how I did that was I created, if you visualize having a boundary ring around you, I like a hula hoop. Okay, so mm-hmm. you have a hula hoop boundary ring around you. And it's like if you wake up every morning and you have, you're struggling with saying no, and you're struggling with multitasking and taking on too much and always saying yes, visualize yourself or state your intention that I'm going to say no. I'm going to learn how to say no just as powerfully as I say yes. And then visualize yourself stepping into an imaginary hula hoop. And that hula hoop is your boundary. It's your personal space. It's your space that allows you to, when someone says, hey, can you bake those brownies for the bake sale? It's your space that allows you to say, hey, you know, I'm not sure what my schedule is. Let me get back to you. And it gives you time to think about it, because so much of the time we knee-jerk. And we say yes just to get someone off our back, or just to say yes.
Mm-hmm,
and it's,
mm-hmm.
it's breaking that habit of knee-jerking.
Okay. And when it comes to saying no and all that stuff, like you said, it's a muscle that you have to get used to saying. Should you give yourself a break while you go through that training period, if you will? Because I think some people would probably come down hard on themselves.
Oh my gosh, yes. Absolutely. It's all about kindness. You know, there are five things you really have to remember when you are building that muscle that makes it easier and less scary, and to be nice to yourself. So that one is to be kind. One is to be determined. The third is to be courageous. You got to know why you're saying no, or why you want to build that no muscle, because mm-hmm. that's really important to connect deep in. And as my grandmother taught me, you got to have the forget about it face, because there are going to be people in your life that are going to push you and are going to relate to you as, you know, the woman you've always been, who always says yes, and is going to keep on needling you until you say yes. And it's building your forget about it face, where you're just like, no, no means no, and standing really firm in that. And back to your point, there are going to be times when you say yes, and yes is a great thing to say. It's just when you're going through this process of building your no muscle, be kind to yourself when you say yes when you really don't want to, and just learn from it and move forward.
Do you think that people who are good girls and or good boys, do you think that they take life too seriously? And if they do, how can they change that to sort of chill out?
I think lots of people take life too seriously, in all honesty, whether or not they classify themselves as a good girl or a good boy. But, you know, serious, life can be difficult, you know, and we get into this mode where it is, we have to be serious because that is how you get through the difficulty. And so much of the time, I just wrote a piece on my blog about finding the funny and laughing and allowing yourself to see the lightness and the joy and the ease of life. If we related to life as more easy and not so hard, we would go with the flow rather than be bucking up against obstacles so much. So I teach my clients to laugh and to enjoy the process, whether or not we're, you know, it's stressful and mucky at the time, is to just know that it is a process and to allow ourselves to be light about it.
Kim, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate all of this excellent advice.
You're welcome. Thank you so much, Kelly.
That was empowerment expert and author Kim Shannon. For more information, check out goodgirlsanonymous.com. A big thank you going out to my guests, TGT, David Phillips, as well as Kim Shannon. Here's your inspirational quote of the week, this time coming from Sri Shinmoy. The word impossible is only in the mind and not in the heart. If we can remain in the heart, there will be no end to our progress. Don't forget to follow us on all of our social media, including our YouTube channel, which is getting lots of hits, youtube.com/KellyAlexanderShow. Also on Twitter, @KAlexanderShow. And you can always find out about all things regarding the show on our website, KellyAlexanderShow.com. Have an awesome week. You and I will chat soon.